The Naples of England by Andy Christopher Miller. Chapter 9. The Naples of England. The people of the town, attentive to the horizon like predators weakened through a long winter, would muster their depleted energies during the first stirrings of spring. They'll be flocking in if this weather keeps up. Shutters and awnings rattling, dust beaten out, accumulated pockets of sand swept from doorways, council vehicles parked up on the empty pedestrians-only promenade, the clatter from lorry loads of deck chairs out of winter storage and being built into stacks on the beach, canoes nestling like sardines, huge floating craft across the backs of youths, their arms splayed as if in crucifixion, carried down to the water's edge. Narrow-strutted jetties wheeled into the sea, prodding the retreating nip of winter still residing in the sea's temperature. In the clear, exacting focus of a new season's light, beach stalls creaking open, crockery clinking and chattering in wire trays, urns subjected to trial runs with bulky masses of steaming water, serving hatches prising open, chalkboards brought out into the daylight, rows of hooks weighted down with joyous trivia. From rooftops, balconies and empty stale interiors, the broken orchestration of hammer and saw, fresh resin and the heady musk of tar and paint, all in preparation for the silver shoals, the flocks alighting, the herds stopping to graze, survival and restoration, appetite and livelihood. My father would be out shopping in the town centre on summer Saturday mornings as early as he could. "If you're not done and home before 10, you might as well forget it," he would say. We took in summer visitors, factory workers and their families from the West Midlands, women and children from South Wales with their huge men who hewed the coal there. "As long as they don't start singing," my father once said, never completely happy with the opening up of our house in this way. My mother advertised in Dalton's Weekly and selected regional newspapers. A neighbour had inducted her into the procedures, but she secreted away what she believed to be the winning words with which she had constructed her three-line classified advertisement. This was the only way we could afford a holiday, my mother said, working my ruddy fingers to the bone. Fried breakfast every morning carried on a tray into our best front room. Sleeping arrangements in weekly flux, my box room the first to be requisitioned. Once I shared the pull-out sofa bed with my mother for the only time it was ever used. And on another occasion, my father and I were in the kitchen on camp beds that had to be dismantled and packed away by 7:15, ready for him to shave at the sink and then for her to scramble pots and utensils ready for the daily conflagration of bacon, eggs, tomatoes and sausages. Sometimes families were split between neighbouring houses, potluck holidaying among the empty or vacated rooms along Purbeck Road. Others occasionally arrived unannounced or on the off chance. Their cases would be brought discreetly inside our privet hedge and the people left standing in the garden while my mother worked her way along the neighbouring doors, permutations being reckoned and resolved in the emergency negotiations. Sometimes there seemed to be transfers after dark, movement between safe houses. And whoever was found a bed, whatever their pairings or combinations, they were to be without trace on Tuesday mornings when the council rent collector made his rounds, for fear that he might note any telltale irregularities, clues to contravention of our tenancy agreements. As a child, the physical appearance on maps of my hometown and its surrounding coastline gave me a thrill each time I saw it. The Naples of England. That was what people called Weymouth, my father told me, because of its perfect bay. I took pride and pleasure in this. Our town was situated at the meeting point of two huge tracts of water that curved in from opposite directions. To the east, the direction that our seafront hotels and esplanade faced was Weymouth Bay, a perfect arc of golden sand, leading first northwards and then round towards deserted, inaccessible cliffs and headlands that on fine days, and most were fine days, We could make out dipping and rising all the way to exotic destinations such as Durdle Door and Lulworth Cove. At the southern end of the town's beach, where the gently shelving sands dipped into a sea that seemed especially warmed in the bowl of the bay, was the pleasure pier, which formed one of the two arms protecting the entrance to Weymouth Harbour. And in the harbour, the ferry boats, passengers embarking to the Channel Islands, huge crates of tomatoes obscuring the sun as they were swung by cranes from the decks of cargo ships down towards us watchers on the dock. On still summer nights, lying in bed, a mile away in Purbeck Road, I could hear the boat train clanking along tracks down the centre of Commercial Road, carrying its passengers from the railway station to the waterside, or screeching and grinding to a halt at some obstruction. If they passed us during the day, stopping the traffic, we could look up at the people in the carriage windows, sitting self-consciously looking down at us. With us, but not of us, like the thousands who covered our sands at the height of the season. Across the harbour, towering above the stone pier, was the Knowth Fort. From the ornamental gardens beside the fort, one could look in one direction, down into the harbour and on towards the pleasure pier, sands and seafront. In the opposite direction was Portland Harbour, battle grey ships, breakwaters with tiny lighthouse buoys, gates and railings and padlocks, access restricted to naval personnel, and then, throwing it all into scale, the huge bulk of Portland squatting in the sea, some 5 miles away. Along the pleasure pier, a huge platform with pontoons sunk into a dark and sunless sea, holidaymakers paraded in their numbers. My parents had met in their youth, through the swimming club, out at the end of this pier. I could just pick them out among the smiling young people, some tentative, others more defiant and self-assured, staring out from the old photograph. Ignore the hairstyles and bathing caps, the one-piece costumes. Ignore a war looming across Europe, and those faces in the strong summer sunshine could be looking out from the 1960s. As the sands curled around to meet the pleasure pier, about a quarter of a mile from the Knowth Gardens, there were the donkeys. When I was young, there was no greater treat than to ride in procession down to the sea's edge on one of their backs. The warm, sweet smell from the dung dropped outrageously onto the sand, the creak and resinous scent from the saddle as I shifted position, the hardened, bony back, the sparse, wiry hair, all gave rare textures to being alive. Right beside the donkeys, the sand modeller's enclosure, Frank Dinnington sculpting huge versions of Salisbury Cathedral, every transept, spire and window precisely fashioned. Or the tableau of the Last Supper, Jesus and his disciples, rounded shoulders and compassionate foreheads, their bodies leaning in towards each other. All made entirely from local sand and water, said the scrawl on the board, and the pennies, threepenny and sixpenny bits trickled down from the promenade into the collecting buckets. Every so often, regularly it seemed, the local paper would carry a photograph of a collapsed cathedral wing, a mighty structure reduced to sand, and a story headlined something like "Smashed by Vandals," and the coins would flow in a heavy torrent. A further 100 yards or so along the sands, you would reach the first aid and the lost children's huts, a pair of semi-detached white-painted wooden huts with an enclosure formed by a white picket fence. These dispensed disinfectant, ointments, and a sense of protection. Most summers, we holidayed at home, or rather my brother and I ran full-bodied between the thousands grouped in deck-chair communities, squeezing between their encampments, in and out of the warm shallows, a whiff of bladder rack, if one could be found, lassoing the air. "Be careful what you're doing with that round people's faces," my mother might warn. "Look out for that yellow dinghy," or something similar she would explain, so that we could find our way eventually back to her deck chair. "And if all else fails, go to the Lost Children's Hut." Another visitor attraction, why would we ever want to travel any further into England, was the tall, thin box painted in red, white and pale blue stripes, Frank Edmund's Punch and Judy stall. Taking my penny for the collecting box as often as I could afford, I would ease my way in among all the visiting children who chanted when required or instructed. Singing through reeds or his huge, curving nose, mad-eyed Mr. Punch, with his stick to his shoulder, surveyed all below him, seeing with a long, lingering look into each of our deceitful hearts.
"Judy, where's the baby?"
"Downstairs."
"Bring it up, bring it up."
"Okay, here's the baby."
Thwack, thwack, thwack. "That's the way to treat the old lady."
One set of guests registered more than most with me when I was 9 years old. A young couple, Paul and his fiancée Marion, stayed one summer with his parents, occupying all three of our bedrooms. A red-haired, tubby and boundlessly enthusiastic young man, Paul, asked my parents if I could accompany Marion and him on a fishing trip so that they could benefit from my knowledge of the choice locations. They also took me with them to the fair. As much as the fishing, the fair, the ice creams and the candy floss, I especially enjoyed evenings in our front room, which my parents had designated the visitor's lounge. Just the three of us, Paul, Marion and myself, while his parents went out, with me enlivening their stay with animated tales of local life. "You can't keep going in that front room," my mother said, oblivious to the camaraderie that we shared. "They've got to be allowed to have a bit of time to themselves." The next spring, I was delighted when Paul wrote to my mother asking if they could again book a week's stay in August. But her manner clearly showed that she did not share my sense of joy. "That Paul from Wolverhampton wants to come again in August, peak season, with that fiancée of his," my mother told my father when he arrived home from work that evening. "Just the two of them." "Great," I replied, before my father could answer. "They can, can't they?" My mother waved the letter in an erratic fashion, as if she was trying to shake it from her own grip. "Says they just want the one room," she added. "I told you this sort of thing would happen when you started all this," my father snapped. "You'll have to write and tell them you're fully booked."
"But we're not," I said. "Mum said so."
My mother held my father's gaze, ignoring me.
"But why can't they come?" I persisted.
"They can't, and that's that."
"But why?" I asked one more time, although I knew that by now the outcome was firmly settled.